Good morning. My name is Ramey Hernandez. I'm from the Las Vegas chapter. I am not, but I wish I were, the Honorable Raul Labrador. First things first, unlike last night, I don't have any notes prepared for today. I am going extemporaneously. And second of all, if Idaho won't take you, Nevada certainly will take you. I practice real estate law, and I've practiced real estate law for about 10 years now. Real estate issues are very near and dear to my heart because I participate. I'm a bankruptcy attorney, and I do foreclosures. And when I first started practicing law, real estate was a real mess in Nevada. And instead of letting the market take care of itself, Nevada thought it was a good idea to impose a lot of statutes and laws and regulations. Well, what should have taken just a few years to buy a home took almost a decade for me to buy a home after I moved there because lenders did not want to lend. There are a lot of costs and effects to legal regulations, and they're not just affecting banks, they also affect consumers as well. And so when Chris Hege and I put together this panel, we wanted to talk about what we felt were really important real estate issues, especially out here out west, because land use is a very important topic out here, and we need to make sure that we're discussing this topic and we're on top of it. So I asked Lawrence Van Dyke here to moderate the panel, and we put together this really great panel. So I'm now going to introduce Lawrence Van Dyke. Lawrence Van Dyke is somebody who really doesn't need much introduction. He is a Ninth Circuit judge. He graduated from Harvard magna cum laude. I had to look that up, right? Magna cum laude. And he was the Solicitor General of Montana. And if he wasn't the first Solicitor General of Nevada, he was the first one that we had in many, many years. As the Solicitor General of Nevada, he fought hard on real property issues for the people of Nevada. And one of the big things he spearheaded, I remember, was the Waters of the U.S. Act, where the U.S. government was probably going to declare your swimming pool a water of the U.S. and subject it to regulation. And it probably would have, probably that lake that we went to yesterday, Waste Lake Village, probably was going to become a water of the U.S. And Lawrence fought really hard for people of Nevada on that and a lot of other issues. So without further ado, I introduce to you the Honorable Lawrence Van Dyke. Thank you.
Thank you, Rami. And thank you, Raul, Attorney General Raul. And thank you for being here. Great, another chapter here at the Western Chapters Conference, another great panel. We're going to jump right into it because I think we're a little behind, but we've got a great group of panelists. My only job is to introduce them, and then I guess if they get in a fight or something, to break it up, I think. But I don't think that's going to happen here. Our topic is the Not-So-Wild West Land Use Regulations in the Western States. We're going to have opening remarks. I believe it's in the order that we're, looks like they actually put us in the order we're going to speak in here. So I'm just going to start with Chris Carr, who's going to kick us off and introduce him. He's a partner in Paul Hastings' San Francisco office, and he chairs the Environment and Energy Practice Group there. He served in both the U.S. Department of Energy and in the U.S. Department of State, and now he represents businesses, landowners, public agencies, and nonprofits in all areas of environmental and natural resources law. His practice focuses extensively on permitting and regulatory litigation. So I think we'll be hearing a lot from Chris about California's unique regulatory challenges, given that Chris practices, a lot of his practice is here in California. And following Chris, we're going to have Jennifer Hernandez talk, and she's a partner leading Holland & Knight's West Coast Land Use and Environmental Group. She splits her time between San Francisco and LA. She works for private sector, public agency, and nonprofit clients in a broad range of projects in the Bay Area, Southern California, and Central Valley communities. She's received numerous civil rights awards for her work in overcoming environmental opposition to housing and other projects that will benefit minority communities. So it'll be really interesting to hear sort of how some of these regulations are affecting. There's a little bit of a tension there in the worldview as to, you know, hurting minority communities. So she's written 3 books, more than 50 articles, and I'm looking forward to hearing her perspective. After Jennifer, we're going to hear from Karen Taylor Robson, who's our only panelist not from California. We try to get some diversity here. She hails from Arizona, where she's founder and president of Arizona Strategies, which is a land use strategy firm headquartered in Phoenix. And before starting that firm, she was executive vice president at DMB Associates, which is a Scottsdale-based master planned community developer. She worked at a law firm before that. She practiced in the area of land use, development, and zoning, In her career, she's entitled more than 35,000 acres of land, including 45,000 homes, and she recently ran for governor of Arizona. And last but not least, Eric Grant will bat cleanup. He's a partner at Hicks Thomas. Before that, he spent 4 years working as a deputy assistant attorney general at DOJ's ENRD, where he had the pleasure of working just a few doors down from me. He was also the top appellate lawyer there. And in that role at ENRD, he litigated environmental and regulatory cases all over the nation and was involved in a lot of high-profile litigation. For example, he spearheaded the government's successful cert petition in the cow pasture case, defending the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. He also worked extensively on the Keystone Pipeline XL litigation and the Giuliano litigation, which is the Kids Against Climate Change litigation. And he's argued in the Supreme Court and clerked for Justice Thomas. So I'm going to have Chris kick it off in just a second. My only concern with this panel is it appears to me like all of them basically make their living because of government regulation. So I'm a little worried that we're not going to be able to have the anti-regulatory perspective from this panel. So hopefully, Chris, maybe you can try to channel that or something, maybe devil's advocate role. But we'll let Chris kick us off.
Thanks so much, Judge. Really appreciate the invitation to be here. As the judge indicated, I do indeed make my living immersed and helping clients navigate California's uniquely challenging environmental regulatory ecosystem, if you will. And I'm going to try to have a little fun with what we're doing today, because in California, around these issues, if you're not able to laugh about it, you end up crying. So let me start off with just mentioning briefly the notorious California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA. Jennifer's going to cover that in more detail. Just want to say a few remarks about it. It's not a little ironic that that law, the first state NEPA law, first state environmental review law, was signed in 1970 by none other than Ronald Reagan. And for the first two and a half decades of its existence, it served its purpose of getting the government to take into account the environmental impacts of activities it undertook or authorized and providing for public participation. It was really worried about sprawl. But for the last couple of decades, it's been weaponized by NIMBYs, by business competitors, by environmental groups, and by labor unions to stymie construction. And if the construction and development goes forward, it's on their terms. Mitigation lands, project labor agreements for the unions, and the like. And so it's gotten us to a situation where California has been put at war with itself. CEQA is frustrating this state's highest policy priorities as declared by the governor, from housing to renewable energy to critical infrastructure to wildfire protection. And you all have the CLE materials, so I'm not going to belabor it. But in there, you'll see a report that I authored for the Pacific Research Institute called the CEQA Gauntlet. And one thing we tried to do there was to go beyond talking about just housing, but to talk about impacts on renewable energy, impacts on clean transportation, and the like. So I'm going to try to broaden out in my remarks today beyond housing and beyond CEQA to focus on other state laws that amount to self-inflicted wounds in the ways they're implemented in California by the agencies and is interpreted by the courts. I have a couple props. Again, in an effort to make this fun, I'll turn first to the California Endangered Species Act and then touch real quickly on California water quality regulation. The California Endangered Species Act, CESA, standalone separate act from the federal law. To develop projects, you gotta go through the permitting process if there's a listed species under CESA, as well as a listed species under the Federal Endangered Species Act. Different agencies, state, federal agencies. Let me start off, first of all, the question is what species get protected? Under California law, the principal court of appeals, the equivalent of the DC Circuit in Sacramento, Third District Court of Appeals last fall, ruled in a published opinion that a bumblebee could be listed under the California Endangered Species Act because it fit within the definition of a fish. I'm not joking.
We have legal cannabis too.
There you go. I'm not joking. And so this is in your materials. It's an incredibly turgid 35-page decision, but this decision made California a laughingstock. So it's not just CEQA that people make fun of. This is another self-inflicted wound, and the petition for review was denied by the California Supreme Court's discretionary review, but the Chief Justice at the time, probably anticipating that a bumblebee being a fish doesn't really comport with common sense, saw fit to issue a very unusual statement accompanying the denial of petition for review. Only she signed it. It was by herself. Let me just read a couple parts from this. First, she went through explaining, well, you know, we're an appellate court, and how can it be that we wouldn't review something that seemed, quote, seems so contrary to common knowledge that bumblebees are not a type of fish, question mark. When her first answer says, were things that simple? Careful analysis of a statute to divine legislative intent can sometimes yield results that might seem surprising at first blush. Understatement of the year, perhaps. And then she gives examples. Courts engaged in this task have interpreted less as more, unlawful as lawful. And in one recent Supreme Court decision, they declared that seas referenced in one statute required no water at all. So I read that, and I'm thinking to myself, okay, Orwell, Humpty Dumpty. And then I landed on, sort of going back to medieval literature, when you look for misrepresentations of something amiss in the land, land's poisoned, corrupt king, crop failures. And it would often be signaled by examples of inversions, very common inversion, a cat barking and dogs meowing, right? And you have these other examples. And so just looking at that, like these inversions are a sign that something is profoundly wrong. And the Chief Justice, I think, is aware of that. At the end of her little statement, short statement, she, I think fantastically, given the state of the legislature in California, said, in the interim, the legislature is in a position to make whatever statutory amendments it may regard as necessary or useful. So that's not gonna happen, as we all know. And so here we are, stuck with this sort of locked in, dysfunctional, sclerotic state of affairs. And I think that's a theme that you'll see coursing through all of our remarks. And then in Q&A, we may be able to talk about what to do about it. So why does this matter? The CESA listing process, if a species is listed, even in California, it's more of a problem because a candidate for listing, a species that hasn't yet been listed, but for which the commission has accepted a petition for listing, unlike the federal act, under the California Act, candidate species get the full protection of the law. So it means you gotta go get an incidental take permit. Incidental take permits are issued by the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. They are challenged with staffing resources, understandably. It takes a lot of time to get those out. And it costs a lot of money because of the habitat mitigation land requirements that have to be paid. So tremendous delay, tremendous cost. I'll just give one recent example of how CESA has been used, the listing process, petition process has been used to stymie development. You've all heard of Shasta Dam up north near Mount Shasta. We obviously have water resource challenges here. We don't have enough water, very arid climate. Well, for years there have been proposals to raise Shasta Dam to provide more water storage capacity. A lot of people don't want to do that. And so what they did is they petitioned the Fish and Game Commission to list a plant called the Shasta Snow Wreath, which only exists around Mount Shasta and would be inundated by Shasta Dam. And the filing of that petition and it's the acceptance of that petition, it's really just almost like a construction punch list. Is there information here that's required to be here for us to consider it? If the commission accepts the petition and becomes a candidate, has the full protection of the California Endangered Species Act. So that's just one example. Shasta Dam is not gonna go forward. if and when the commission lists the Shasta snow wreath as an endangered species, and is considering doing that at its next meeting in February. There are plenty of other examples to talk about. We'll increasingly see the conflict between species that are allegedly threatened by climate change and the need to build out renewable energy in the desert, for example. And so I think we'll see that in the years ahead, and CBD and other environmental groups that are petitioning to list these species they say are climate threatened, many of them at the same time recognize on their own terms that the solution to climate change over the long term is renewable energy. So again, California's policy priorities at war with itself. Next, I'll move on quickly to state water quality regulation. As you know, the state agencies in California implement both the Federal Clean Water Act as well as a state equivalent, California Port of Colon Water Quality Control Act. Just a real quick example, the San Francisco Bay Regional Board undertook to revise regional stormwater permits last summer. In the process, they wanted to effectively include inclusionary housing requirements. That is, the water quality regulator took it upon itself to try to mandate an increase in the development of low-income and affordable housing. I won't go into the details of the mechanics. There's a requirement for low-impact development that you try to have as much green space as possible rather than cement, so that water can run into the ground rather than over cement where it picks up dirt and then causes pollution. But what the regional board proposed to do last summer was to increase the percentage of low-income and affordable housing that was required for a project, an infill project no less, in order to receive credits for so-called low-impact development. Well, this was going to tremendously raise the costs of infill development and make project financing for such housing impossible. It was such a crazy thing to do, this agency putting its nose where it doesn't belong, that two very effective members of the California legislature, very, very liberal, State Senator Scott Wiener from San Francisco and Assemblymember Buffy Wicks from Berkeley, they've been trying to get more housing built. They understand the problem. What the regional board did made them actually send a letter, and again, this is in your materials, where they wrote a joint letter, what you're trying to do, quote, will prevent housing production and exacerbate the housing crisis by imposing exorbitantly high inclusionary housing requirements and regulations. I won't go through all of it. Some great language. We also note that this proposed order places the water board squarely in the middle of housing policy. Respectfully, the water board should not be setting housing policy. So it goes on and on, saying please stay in your lane, regulate water quality rather than enacting housing policy and environmental and water quality regulation. So another type of example of California's self-inflicted wounds. And then last, I'll touch real quickly here on federal law developments in the species and water quality area. Eric will cover this in more detail when he talks about litigation that he's been involved in. But two examples real quickly of nationwide regulations of the prior federal administration for water quality and species. First, Clean Water Act, Section 401, water quality certification. It's about the water quality permitting process at the state level. Basically, the state water quality agencies here, the regional water quality control boards in California, get to impose conditions on any federal permit, whenever a federal permit's needed. And the conditions they impose are allegedly to ensure compliance with state water quality standards. Well, the prior federal administration reformed that process to diminish some of the ability of the states to do that, create some streamlining so that projects could go forward. That was challenged by environmental groups and a blue state coalition led by California, and the suit was filed in the Northern District of California. not surprisingly. The district court judge, William Alsup, former law clerk for Justice Douglas, who, as you know, was called Wild Bill. Well, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, judicial clerk-wise, it seems. And Judge Alsup saw fit to vacate, that there was a motion to remand the regulation brought by the Biden administration so they could reconsider it if they wanted. Judge Alsup didn't just grant the motion to remand, he saw fit to vacate the regulations in their entirety without having reached the merits, without a preliminary injunction motion having been brought by the plaintiffs. So the plaintiffs got everything they wanted, with even now having to bring a PI and without any merits ruling. Well, that was appealed to the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit left it in place, and the defendants, the industry interveners, and Red State Coalition took it to the Supreme Court. And in April 2022, the Supreme Court issued a stay of Judge Alsup's ruling, of his pre-merits vacator ruling, and slapped that down. Nevertheless, in another case, in a case that I had before Judge Tiger in ND Cal, where there was a challenge, I was representing the industry interveners, Farm Bureau, AP, American Petroleum Institute, the homebuilders and the like, in defending the Trump administration reforms to the Federal Endangered Species Act implementing regulations. And I've been doing species permitting for 25 years. These were modest reforms. This was not what the Washington Post said in August 2019 when they were first issued that Trump guts ESA. This was a very thoughtful rulemaking, took 3 years in the making, was really done by the career people at the Department of the Interior Solicitor Office, and they stood behind it. So this is really within the channels, nothing radical here. Nevertheless, suit filed in ND Cal by Blue State Coalition, led by California, and environmental groups led by Center for Biological Diversity. Judge Tiger, after 3 years of litigation, and after the Supreme Court issued the stay with respect to Judge Alsup's ruling, nevertheless saw fit in July of last year to vacate, to not just remand the regulations, but to vacate them as well, taking them off the books, just wiping them clean. We appealed to the Ninth Circuit and sought a writ to ask the court to address the clear error committed by Judge Tiger. Instead, the Ninth Circuit panel, citing the Supreme Court decision, granted the writ and directed Judge Tiger to address his decision consistent with the Supreme Court decision. He did that. And so in November, Judge Tiger corrected his error. The panel decision granting the writ is in your materials. It's worth reading. It's very short, but it also contains a very thoughtful concurrence by our moderator here. So I would direct
sure,
your
that
attention
was not
to
short.
That. And so, again, what you're seeing here, sort of the system we have is broken. It's not working. Modest, refined amendments to the Federal Endangered Species Act to streamline permitting of all manner of projects, housing, renewable energy, critical infrastructure, and the like, frustrated in and by California. So with that, I'll turn it over to Jennifer.
Thanks, Chris. So typically in a conference like this, the question is really, okay, you people are crazy, why do I care? And the answer to that question is California sneezes and the country catches a cold. We spread, and this doctrine spreads. And Chris has given you some examples, and I'm sure that Karen and Eric will continue. I wanted to focus, though, given this audience, on administrative law. No law student should show up at our law firm door looking to work with us unless you've taken admin law. It's a really important area of law to study. it also, in practice, has almost no relevance in ways that I'm going to just discuss. A couple background facts. California has the nation's highest poverty rate once you take housing costs into account, which the Obama administration did. We also have the nation's largest and highest population of unhoused residents, which is the current appropriate term that we need to use, as opposed to housed residents. We have a housing crisis of just unimaginable proportions. McKenzie said it was a $3.5 million home shortage, but our housing cost price points are almost nine times more than our median income, as contrasted with the national price points of homes, which are about four times higher than the median income. And that's a financeable and save-upable goal. Nine times is not. The population most adversely affected, other than obviously the unhoused residents, are median income workers. And my dad and both grandfathers were steel workers in Pittsburgh, California. That was us. And home ownership is what saved both of my grandparents and my parents, my grandparents, my grandmothers during 20-year widowhoods, and my parents when my dad was permanently laid off from the steel mill in California's version of the Rust Belt in his 50s. Depriving middle-income workers of home ownership is also a deprivation that disparately affects minority populations because we now are a majority-minority state. And so there is a civil rights consequence to having regulated ourselves into unaffordable housing that simply doesn't exist by 3 million homes or so. Nevertheless, the tool, and Chris touched on it, the California Environmental Quality Act, is used, as we just reported over the summer in a report for the California Business Roundtable, the California Environmental Quality Act lawsuits in 2020 aimed at about 55,000 housing units, and notwithstanding years of struggle, our production of housing is still at about 110,000 a year. So more than half of the housing projects that we manage to produce every year, a miracle in itself, are on the wrong side of CEQA lawsuits. What is this thing and why do you care? 1970, Ronald Reagan was also, Brady Bunch was in first run. It was a long time ago. We didn't have the Endangered Species Act. We didn't have the Coastal Protection Act. We didn't have any of the toxics laws, including the Clean Air Act.
We didn't have the EPA.
We didn't have the EPA. It was formed months later by President Nixon. But it was a long time ago. And in 1972, in the first case to hit the California Supreme Court, interpreting this law called CEQA, modeled on NEPA, but written by non-lawyers with very fatal consequences, the California Supreme Court said the environment's really important. We all love it. We do. It's one of the reasons we put up with California. But the court said, so we need to interpret this environmental protection law broadly to protect the environment. And with that sentence, all learnable administrative law principles were washed aside. Plain language didn't matter. Legislative intent didn't matter. Contextual interpretation and application didn't matter. There were 30 years worth of efforts to expand the California Endangered Species Act to include insects, which the federal but not state statute doesn't. There was an AG opinion saying it doesn't include insects. Nevertheless, Justice Roby in his lead decision found that bees were fish and thus we cover insects. That's not consistent with administrative law jurisprudence. And the issue we're facing is right now the environment is not 1970. Like it or not, the existing setting, existing environmental conditions aren't so good. We've mismanaged our forests. Our water isn't where our people are. We don't have enough housing. And with housing comes that irritating need to drink and have a place to treat wastewater and have a school for the kids. We need to make changes. And those changes are pretty dramatic to the existing environment. And you think, okay, fine, we'll have some regs and we'll figure out how to do this. CEQA is not bound by regs. We have something we call guidelines that courts have recognized as having the force and effect of regs. But at most, they're kind of looked at as a floor, not a ceiling. More than 50 years after CEQA was enacted, an appellate court in San Francisco issued a tentative decision just before Christmas involving a proposed dorm and already existing, more or less, expansion of the UC Berkeley flagship campus, concluded for the very first time in history, it's not written anywhere, even in, you know, lemon juice that you have to, like, hold under a flame to see, that social noise from future residential occupants is a CEQA impact. It's partying undergrads. In a lawsuit brought by neighbors who moved next to the biggest campus on the UC system. And yet, the environment is both big E, climate change, endangered species, and little E. I don't want to listen to those people. That's my environment. Well, and People's Park is yet another feature of this. Berkeley, UC Berkeley, in its woke wisdom, decided that it would try to overcome decades of mostly boomer opposition to People's Park, which before it was taken over by the university was full of low-income kind of single-family homes that had been cannibalized by students. So the campus took it over and wanted to build dorms. It was big riots and whatnot, deaths. People feel pretty passionately about it. But Berkeley decided, okay, let's make it a real park, but also let's make it a dorm. And because there are many unsheltered residents living in the park, Berkeley stepped out and said, we're going to be the first campus in the nation to create a 100-bed homeless shelter, which is incredible. Has a separate entrance, at least, from the dorm, but it's part of the dorm structure. And the tentative opinion by the three-judge panel concluded that bringing more people and housing to that part of Berkeley, which already had a homelessness and housing affordability crisis, would result in a housing displacement impact, causing others to leave. And then where would they go? And Berkeley being Berkeley had a whole plan. Well, we'll tell people in advance, we'll counsel them, we'll give them money to relocate. If need be, we will find them housing. And the court said that mitigation wasn't good enough. Now, I have to tell you, I've done this for almost 40 years, 39 years now. None of this was knowable in advance as a lawyer. We had no hint that these were, in fact, part of CEQA. Who knew? And there was another case that came out by a different panel in the same court that for the first time ever concluded a very famous CEQA petitioner lawyer had engaged in malicious prosecution by filing a meritless CEQA claim involving a single-family home in San Anselmo, a very precious community in Marin County full of environmental NIMBYs, of a homeowner who wanted to build a granny flat for his mother-in-law during COVID and get her out of an assisted living facility. And the neighbors weren't having any of it. And this lady sued, this plaintiff's lawyer sued, and the court was so irritated that it found that lawsuit, which was poorly done, and she is nevertheless the plaintiff's judge who has for years taught judicial college in California to CEQA judges who have to be assigned on the bench, found that she had engaged in malicious prosecution. Incredible. But more incredible, and back to admin law, was the fact that two of the most distinguished law professors in this area of law, Sean Hecht at UCLA and Richard Frank, now at UC Davis, but prior to that, the top cop in the environmental division of the Attorney General's office, wrote an amicus, citing my data, by the way, and quoting me, thank you, that CEQA outcomes are virtually unknowable. In 15 years of appellate court decision-making, it's about a 50-50 chance. It's a coin toss. And they said, well, given this, it's impossible to engage in malicious prosecution because, after all, who knows what could happen? And these are two distinguished law professors defending a state of law which seems to me to have more in common with what one might find in Moscow or Beijing. What is going on and who is being hurt? And I'll tell you, the people who are being hurt are those that don't have, those that need, and future generations that are kind of hoping they too can have any level of even modest stability, let alone upward mobility or prosperity. We've allowed our environmental law, as Senator Weiner, a very progressive, very, very liberal Democratic Party leader in Sacramento, has said, is CEQA is the law that swallowed California. Only 6% of California is urban, according to the Air Resources Board. I don't know, that might be comparable to Arizona. We're getting close. And yet we've decided as a climate matter that all new development has to happen inside our urban boundaries. In our urban boundaries, our neighbors who exist already. And one of the many things that another article I did called Green Jim Crow demonstrated is CEQA is used by whiter, wealthier neighbors to block change far more than it's used by anyone. In fact, in the first of these CEQA studies, looking at 3 years of all CEQA lawsuits filed statewide, only 13% were brought by recognized environmental groups. We don't have a standing requirement. We don't even have a disclosure requirement. Anonymous parties can sue. And the most common remedy in CEQA, even famously, and I'll close here, for a judge that blocked a housing project in San Francisco some years ago because he concluded one intersection was improperly counted on one weekday. CEQA documents now run to thousands of pages. That was the defect. The most common remedy by far is rescind all project approvals, start over. Start over with whatever the new rule book is. Start over with whatever the surprising new case that you didn't know about at the time you did the CEQA documentation that concluded you've missed an impact for which you had no prior notice. No balancing, no rulemaking, no necessity, and absolutely no recognition of any other area of law, including fair housing. We love the environment. Right now, the environment has swallowed what all of us say we want and need, which is fair housing, stability, if not upward mobility, and a massive transformation of our environment to the tune of 2 million acres to our currently developed 6 to accommodate solar at an unprecedented scale. We're just talking ourselves into nothing. And that's the, I will make one concluding remark. The way we calculate climate change progress is by reducing greenhouse gas impacts, emissions, within how we count them. We count them as anthropogenic impacts that happen in California, mostly from energy consumption. The best way in a drought to reduce my family's water use is to export my teenage son. California's greenhouse gas metrics count favorably exporting people and jobs to other states. We're coming at you. And that's how we're going to achieve our first in the world commitment to net zero greenhouse gas by 2045. Thanks.
Well, I don't think you need any more explanation than what Chris and Jennifer just gave you as to why, in the U-Haul Index, California is still number 50 for people moving out of your state. So, and they're not only coming to Montana and Idaho, but they're coming in droves to Arizona. So I also want to give a nod to the Attorney General and your mother and the anecdote you gave about your mother. because I too had a mother who was a lifelong Democrat and a huge fan of the Kennedy family until they moved west to Arizona and my mother read Barry Goldwater's Conscience of a Conservative. She immediately changed her party registration and started knocking doors for Barry Goldwater with me in vitro. In utero, excuse me. And that's when I got my start in Republican politics, when she was knocking doors for Barry Goldwater. And it is truly an honor and a privilege to be here. My very first job out of school was working for Ronald Reagan at the White House. And that experience set me on a path that has led me to where I am today. And I couldn't be more proud of the legacy of Ronald Reagan, with a minor exception of CEQA. So at the time, I'm sure it was all well intended. But I'd like to talk more generally about the rising cost of housing. And I know in the panel description, we wanted to touch on short-term housing and short-term rentals, which has caused quite a stir all over this country as of late. But in Arizona, our housing prices are rising as faster than anywhere else because of the influx of people. In Maricopa County alone, which is the fourth largest county in America, we are one of the fastest growing counties in America. And they're not all coming from California. We're getting a lot from other blue states as well. In fact, if you go back and look at that U-Haul index, the top 10 states are states led by Republican governors, and the bottom 10 states are states, with one exception, I believe, are run by Democrat governors. And so these policies matter, and these policies have real impact on things such as housing. So what else is leading to the increase in housing prices other than the regulatory and administrative travails occurring here in California? But is land constraint. You know, Jennifer just talked about, you know, all the development in California has to occur in certain areas. Well, in Arizona, we're constrained by the fact that 83% of our land in Arizona is owned by the public. In fact, 40% of the land in Arizona is owned by the federal government, and which is about 28 million acres. Federal government's the largest landowner in the country with 640 million acres. So federal policy obviously has a major, major impact on the availability of land for development purposes. Also, the other contributing factors, and as Judge Van Dyke indicated, I am fresh off of a gubernatorial campaign which took me all over the state of Arizona and learned an awful lot about the other impacts to housing prices. Labor. In every industry, and the housing industry is no exception, labor cost and material cost, all of these things conspiring together are just making these land or housing prices go through the roof. And so the people at the bottom rung of the ladder are simply left out in the cold. And Arizona is just really, really starting to deal with that, not just on the regulatory side, but also on the local political front. We are 270,000 multifamily units short of our current demand in Arizona. And yet the local jurisdictions are clamping down. Residents of the local communities are coming out in droves to fight any and all attempts to add to the housing stock. So I'm gonna back up and go back into a little bit of my career and working in California. I've been at this for 30 years, and for about half of that time, I split my time between Arizona and California projects. And I would come to these California projects, and Jennifer was our attorney on many of them, and I would go home a little more depressed. And half the time, we'd have to go to D.C. because the land use game in California is very sophisticated, far more sophisticated than it is in Arizona. And oftentimes, that would take you to Washington, D.C., and I would literally come back thinking, you know, I'd go there thinking we've got the greatest government, greatest country in the world, and I'd come back just depressed. And I told a lot of people when I was running for governor that I did this because I spent so much time in Arizona or in California that I saw the future, and it wasn't pretty. And I didn't want Arizona to be that place. But, you know, the federal government impacts all of us. One of the things I used to say I would ask this question on the campaign trail, and very few people could answer, but I'm hoping, since this is a room full of attorneys, you guys can answer these questions. How many crimes are enumerated in the Constitution? Does anybody know? Oh, come on. There's three. treason, piracy, and counterfeiting. How many federal statutes carry criminal sanctions? Gone through the process, signed into law? Any guess? 5,000. It gets better. How many federal regulations carry criminal sanctions? These are regulations, unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats promulgating regulations that could put you in jail. We're probably breaking a couple of them right now. 300,000 was the last number I heard, and it might be more than that. That is the definition of tyranny. That, my friends, is the reason we have a housing crisis across this country, because you can't get anything done without running that gauntlet. That's in large measure why I ran for governor, because it's not going to be solved in Washington, D.C., where you have this bureaucracy that just continues to grow on the inertia of itself. It is going to be governors and state governments that rein this in. And how many of you are live in California now? Show of hands. Okay, I assumed most of you would be. I have no idea what it's going to take to jolt California back into reality so that we can all, you know, live in housing that we can afford, and so that we're not all compelled, like Jennifer, to send her son somewhere else for a better life.
It's okay sometimes.
I mean, you know, every time we visit California, it is so beautiful. It's like, how in the heck does this place still manage to maintain itself? But because it's so beautiful, and just think what you could achieve. So real quick, I'm going to talk, as I mentioned, about short-term rentals, because I know that was on the agenda. So Arizona was one of the first states to pass a preemption law. Governor Ducey, back in 2016, passed a law that the state preempted local zoning. So local zoning could not regulate short-term rentals. So very quickly, Arizona rose to the top. I think we were number 5 in the nation for short-term rental revenues. VRBO, Expedia, Airbnb loved Arizona. And of course, the unregulated environment led to a reaction from local neighborhood organizations and residents who came unglued and have been really pressuring the local governments. After about 2 years of negotiation, they finally came to a peace where they have now they claim a 4-year moratorium or 5-year moratorium on not going back to the legislature again. But they succeeded last year in allowing local governments some modicum of control to regulate short-term rentals. So we'll see how long this truce lasts, but it has put back into the hands of local government the opportunity to license and permit and have some regulatory authority over short-term rentals. But this is, you know, this is an area that affects housing, affects the cost of housing, because we've had investors come in and buy, you know, not just one house, two houses, but sometimes portfolios of houses. So it has an impact on the demand for housing, and therefore it has an impact on the cost of housing. But we'll see in Arizona how this works. But Arizona, you know, was really in the lead position, for better or for worse, on the lack of regulation for short-term rentals. We now have some bit of governor on that at the local level. So we'll see as this plays out over the next couple of years if other states follow suit. But with that, I'm excited to hear from Eric and some of the great work he has been doing. In particular, I hope you're going to touch on the Sackett case, because we, you know, the Clean Water Act, for some of us have worked on that, and Section 404 of the Clean Water Act, for the better part of our career. So I'm very, very anxious to hear what's going on there. So, Eric.
Thank you, Karen. Eric is going to tell us how the federal government can save us from all of this. So.
Well, thank you to Judge Van Dyke for his introduction, and to the Federalist Society for inviting me to this august conference. As the judge mentioned, I spent 4 years litigating federal environmental issues, mostly in the Ninth and Tenth Circuits, on behalf of federal agencies. That brought me into daily contact with the unholy trinity of federal environmental statutes: the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, or ESA, and the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA. Those three statutes have deep and wide effects on land use throughout the western states. And a prominent example is the long-running battle between residential property owners in Idaho and EPA in Sackett v. EPA argued on the first Monday of last October in the Supreme Court. Now, I represented EPA when the case was most recently pending in the Ninth Circuit, but, and I trust I can say this without violating my duty of loyalty to a former client, I hope the Sacketts prevail. You probably know that federal jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act is limited by the statutory term navigable waters, which is defined to mean, quote, waters of the United States, including the territorial seas, unquote. The term waters of the United States, or WOTUS for the cognoscenti, is not further defined. So if you're like me, you might conclude that all this boils down to federal waters are waters that are federal. Now, courts and regulators have struggled with this definition for decades. In 1985, a unanimous Supreme Court told us that federal waters need not be navigable in fact, and that federal agencies may exercise jurisdiction over so-called adjacent wetlands. Those are wetlands adjacent to but not regularly flooded by rivers, streams, and other real waters. But how far does adjacency reach? In its infamous 2006 decision in Rapanos v. United States, the Supreme Court split 4-1-4 on the answer to that question. And it won't surprise you that Justice Kennedy, writing for himself alone, supplied what has turned out to be the controlling opinion. And that opinion held that a water or wetland constitutes navigable waters if it possesses a significant nexus to waters that are navigable in fact. You got that? Now, the Sacketts reasonably believe that their two-thirds of an acre near Priest Lake lacked such a nexus. As described by the government, their parcel is bounded by roads to the north and south, and the south road separates them from Priest Lake by about 300 feet. And the north road, which is paved, separates their parcel from a large wetland complex, which includes an unnamed tributary that is about 30 feet away from their parcel. So in short, the Sacketts property is adjacent to, in the sense of next to, neither the lake nor the wetlands. Nevertheless, after the Sacketts dumped gravel and sand on portions of their property in order to build a house, the Army Corps of Engineers determined that those portions constituted waters of the United States because they were wetlands adjacent to, but not directly abutting, relatively permanent waters that flow directly into traditional navigable waters. Now, I have a Prop 2, and this is a picture of the Sacketts on their property. It doesn't look very wet. Now, that may be because they dump sand and gravel on it. But EPA then issued an administrative compliance order commanding the Sacketts to cease construction and to restore their property, all on pain of tens of thousands of dollars of civil penalties. And they've spent nearly two decades fighting that determination, and they're now back in the Supreme Court. And the smart money set thinks that the Supreme Court took their case looking for a way to undo the damage it did in Rapanos, to clean up its mess, and to do so in a way that reins in federal agencies' expansive interpretation of the Clean Water Act. And I say none too soon. The Rapanos plurality observed that the average applicant for an individual Clean Water Act permit spends 788 days and more than $271,000 in completing the process. And that's not counting costs of mitigation or design changes. And I will say that those figures ring true in my experience representing EPA and the Army Corps. And according to the plurality, federal agencies have interpreted their jurisdiction over waters of the United States to cover nearly 300 million acres of swampy lands throughout the country. Now, another example of the profound influence of federal environmental statutes on land use throughout the western United States is the U.S. Bureau of Land Management's efforts for more than a decade to manage 68 million acres of sagebrush habitat. Now, given Karen, or I think it was Karen's figure of 600 million acres, that's more than 10% of all federal land. And the BLM is doing this for the benefit of the endangered species known as the greater sage grouse. Doesn't look very great to me, but this little bird is causing turmoil on 68 million acres of federal lands. And among BLM's plans to manage these sagebrush focal areas is to withdraw all of them from mining, and that's about 10 million acres of federal land. And speaking of mining, and finally, federal environmental statutes bear profoundly on land use throughout the western states in the context of ushering in the nirvana of a decarbonized economy. Now, that imagined future entails electric cars, solar power, and wind power. And what do those things entail? Well, electric cars require lithium-ion batteries that contain lithium, copper, and other minerals. And solar panels require massive amounts of copper and aluminum. Wind turbines likewise require copper and aluminum, plus nickel. And all of these things require a reliable electric transmission grid. You might have heard me repeat copper, which is ubiquitous in the high-tech, low-carbon future, even though I think of it as a 19th century metal. Our phone lines are made of copper. And where will we get all of this copper and other minerals? Well, we'll mostly get them by digging them out of the ground. In a word, we will mine them. Now, felicitously, the Western United States have vast reserves of both copper and lithium. Prominent examples in Arizona for copper and in Nevada for lithium. Thus, for more than a decade, the Rosemont Copper Company sought and in 2017 received approval from the U.S. Forest Service to dig a large open pit copper mine in the Coronado National Forest and predicted that that mine would produce nearly 6 billion pounds of copper over the next 25 years. And in 2021, the BLM approved the largest lithium mine in the country on federal land near Thacker Pass, Nevada. But all of the copper and lithium remain in the ground. In the Rosemont case, a district court vacated the approvals under the ESA, NEPA, and the Mining Law of 1872. And if you can believe it, the Ninth Circuit affirmed that decision. In the Nevada lithium case, the Biden administration is so far defending a challenge brought under NEPA in federal district court in Nevada, with a ruling expected soon. And I myself represent plaintiffs who are attacking, under NEPA and the Clean Water Act, a wind energy project offshore of Long Island. And so the low-carbon future is being stymied, ironically, some might say, by federal environmental statutes. And with that, I yield my time.
We've only got a few minutes. Thank you to all my panel members. And we only have a few minutes left, and I want to make sure we have time for questions. So I think somebody's got microphones. And so if you raise your hand, I will and try to ask a quick and short question. I'm going to ask the panelists, and moderator's privilege to ask the first question. Can you give us, each one of you give us one, you know, this has been a little bit depressing, maybe. And so could each one of you maybe give us one hopeful, something that is maybe possible that could happen that would be something that would be good for the problems you're talking about. One real short answer, because we're going to run out of time.
Better judicial picks at both state and federal level.
I did not plant that answer, so.
He was talking about you.
Jennifer?
The legislature has tried fixes. It's told judges, don't interpret CEQA, for example, to require anything that's not expressly there, 1994 statute. Don't undo this project approval, which they only give to favored stadium projects and their own office project in Sacramento. Don't undo this project approval unless the defect involves a public safety impact or a tribal impact. And judges simply use their equitable power to bypass those plain language restrictions on writ authority. So what, I'd turn it back, not to you necessarily, Judge, but what's it going to take for judges to actually comply with statutes again?
I got to just say one more thing on that score about judges. Jennifer mentioned earlier the typical remedy in California courts for CEQA violation, wipe the slate clean, unwind everything. The law does not require that. It simply doesn't require it. So it is within their equitable discretion,
Karen?
But not common sense.
Well, you have me stumped. In order to get good judicial nominations, you need to get good elected officials. So elections matter.
I think the Sackett decision is going to stop the merry-go-round of regulatory changes from the Bush administration to the Obama administration to Trump to Biden. I think, at least in the Clean Water Act arena, there'll be some sanity.
Can I jump in on that? I would hope so. You're very optimistic, because it's just a matter of whoever is the next administration, and they'll change it. They will find ways to change it. And I hope you're right that we get off the merry-go-round, but based on, you know, living through and watching now, you know, 4-5 administrations in my career, it just, that merry-go-round just seems to, sometimes it speeds up, but it just seems to keep going around and around. Back to my Washington, D.C. is irretrievably broken.
Nobody mentioned move to Idaho, but I think as, you know, there's always that option. So, questions, who we got?
Yes, thank you. Excellent panel. Tim Kowal from Orange County. Some of the panelists mentioned the housing issue and how a lot of these land use regulations and housing restrictions are driving homelessness and poverty, for example. And a lot of us in the room, us right-wing wackos, have been probably saying that for a lot of years. But now even liberals in good standing at the Atlantic are acknowledging that well, yeah, I know we've been saying that it's addiction and other problems, mental illness that's driving homelessness. But or maybe it's the warm weather. Everyone, all the homeless people want to flock to the coastal regions to become homeless. But that's actually not driving the case. You have, wherever you see restrictive housing policies, whether it's cold states or warm states, you have homelessness. And in centers where there's high concentrations of drug addiction and mental illnesses, you don't necessarily see homelessness. So it is housing policy and land use restrictions that are driving homelessness. I wonder what can be done about that. Is this sort of housing Malthusianism somehow implicate the constitutional right to travel? If I'm from another state and I see the U-Haul rates are, hey, pretty good, I could probably get a good rate to move to California, but golly, 9x median multiple on the housing prices, that's prohibitive, I can't move there. Is that a restriction on the right to travel to California? Does that implicate the federal constitutional right?
So we do have three lawsuits pending on behalf of a civil rights group called the 200, including now 80-plus-year-old co-founders of La Raza Nationally. Former Justice Cruz Reynoso was part of it before he passed away, arguing, among other things, on right to travel. But here's the solution as far as I have been able to fumble through. Boomers are dying. Not enough yet, but we're getting there.
Is that the solution?
I swear to God.
This went dark.
And so what's then happened is millennials, who are huge, have sort of dealt with us for years, and they're pretty irritable, but they're a big group. And they're finally hitting 40, which means they need to start thinking about having children. It's a kind of different. And they can't afford to buy a home, and they're really tired, finally, of spending $5,000 or $6,000 a month in rent. Now, this took a long time, but it's here. I have a bunch of Silicon Valley clients, and one of them, who's a billionaire, I think maybe 41, said, this housing thing doesn't even work for me anymore, and I'm a billionaire. I mean, if I want to hire a nanny, I have to buy her a home. Okay, then stop giving unlimited amounts of money to environmental advocacy groups who fight everything. And by the way, they do fight everything. There's a whole PTSD trauma group called the Decarbonization Coalition, which is like algae and biogas and all these other things, where there are words that say we like you, but all the policies say wind, solar, battery, and go away everybody else. So there is a boomerang that needs to happen, that is starting to happen, and it's why we have progressive California Democrats in the Bay Area kind of leading the charge on housing. Unfortunately, they're leading the charge to do literally, they put out this report, the Turner Center at Berkeley, missing middle housing. What are we going to do about middle income housing? Huge issue. They define it as backyard casitas, little small homes, or apartments, rental apartments in 10 to 20 unit buildings. Now, you take an average union household, like my steelworker household, or a cop, or a nurse, and say, yeah, soon you'll be able to afford to live in someone else's backyard cottage, one bedroom. Or welcome back to dingbats, you know, it worked so well after World War II, you're back in a 10-unit walk-up, and it's 10 to 20, so you don't have to do elevators. That's not a sustainable future unless everybody who needs it moves out of California, in which case we'll have the largest senior community in the world.
So I think we may have time for one more quick question. So we can at least say we had two questions other than mine. Is anybody else, or we are over? Oh yeah, we have somebody right here.
Hello, David McDonald, Mountain States Legal Foundation, Colorado. I've been conditioned over many years of eye rolls when I mention the Dormant Commerce Clause, but there's a recent circuit split coming out of the Fifth Circuit with the Ninth Circuit on short-term rentals on this idea that these are the residency requirements are a violation of the Dormant Commerce Clause. And I'm curious what the panelists' thoughts are, if anything, on using the Dormant Commerce Clause in this way, especially in the opposition to the Thomas Court. Thomas is not a fan, but I'm curious if anyone thinks that this is a path forward.
I have not thought of that, so I wish I had a thoughtful response for you. I've looked at the preemption at the state level. I'm a big advocate of local government, local control. Even though I was, very much a fan of our former governor, I was not a fan of the preemption of the state of Arizona over local government. And I am glad that local government, once again, has some modicum of control. But I have not looked at the question you asked, so it's a good one.
I'm guessing the answer, probably the Supreme Court's decision in the Port case will probably, influence the answer to that decision, too. So stay tuned, I guess, right? All right, well, thank you very much to my panel, and thank you to our audience.